Modern Love, the podcast, is supported by...
This podcast is supported by Cartier. In celebration of the Trinity Collection's 100th anniversary, Cartier shares testaments of love in all its forms from around the world. Please keep listening for today's love story later in this episode.
From the New York Times and WBUR Boston, this is Modern Love. Stories of love, loss, and redemption. I'm your host, Meghna Chakrabarty. The perfect first date. It usually lives only in our dreams. Candlelight, delicious food, an instant connection. But in reality, first dates can be an awkward mess. And the conversation? Shallow, at best. Which is the worst thing about first dates for Tim Boomer. He's the author of this week's essay. Paul Rust, star of the Netflix comedy Love, reads us Tim's essay, The End of Small Talk.
When my relationship unraveled nearly 2 years ago, I decided to suspend my career as an actuary in Boston and take a long vacation in Costa Rica, where I planned to learn how to surf and do yoga. Yes, it was the most cliched response possible for a heartbroken 32-year-old man. After 4 weeks there, I was traveling by car with several friends I had met at surf school when we came upon a red-faced, middle-aged woman hitchhiking on the outskirts of a small village. Our radio was broken and we were bored, so one woman in our group, Abby, said, "We'll offer you a ride on two conditions. First, you must sing us a song, and then you have to tell us a story. Do you accept?" The hitchhiker, an American, responded with a crooked smile and a nod, freeing her hair from behind a Disney visor. "What would you like me to sing?" she asked. "Anything you like," I told her. "As long as it's by Rod Stewart." One rendition of Maggie May later, her story began. "It's interesting you ask me to tell you a story," she said, "because I'm living in the middle of a love story right now. I came to Costa Rica 1 year ago and met the man of my dreams. He was selling jewelry at a stand in the market. He's Italian, and as soon as I spoke to him, I felt something I hadn't felt in my whole life. It overtook me. Love, like in the movies, but this was real." This story sounded promising for sure. "So you're here to see him?" one of my friends asked. "Yes, absolutely, dear. I'm heading into town now to see him for the first time in 12 months. We broke into huge grins. We too were now characters in her story, deliverers of love from a dusty roadside to the man of her dreams. "Does he feel the same way?" Abby asked. "Yes, he emails me every day to tell me so." I turned to her. "Are you excited to see him?" "I haven't thought about anything else for an entire year." "So you came all this way alone to see him?" I asked. "Well, I had to, didn't I? It was breaking my heart to be away from him." She paused for a breath. "Although, my husband came too. He's back at the house." Our hands shot up with questions. After my trip, I was eating steak at a Boston bar, still mourning that the woman I thought I would marry, Alejandra, had broken up with me. I'd met her 5 years earlier, and she was, in every way imaginable, an inspiration to me. She was the woman who taught me about love. Next to me at the bar was a couple on their first date. I could tell because their conversation reminded me of those awkward exchanges you have with coworkers' spouses at Christmas parties. They opened with a discussion about their commutes to the bar. They both lived within a 10-minute bus ride, and they managed to stretch out this topic for 30 minutes. Next up, the weather. In Boston, it rains sometimes, and they had both noticed this. An hour in, they turned to the really deep stuff. One was a teacher, and the other knew a teacher. How could they be destined for anything other than true love? Okay, so I may have been directing some of my broken-hearted anger at them, but all I could think was that I wanted no part of this game. If being single meant having to partake in this kind of conversation, I'd rather pass. How could I go from the deep connection I had with Alejandra to talking about bus schedules and weather patterns? With this in mind, I decided to approach my re-entry to dating with a no small talk policy. Not that I would insist we talk only about heartfelt subjects. Ideally, there would also be plenty of flirtatious joking and witty banter. I simply wanted to eliminate the dull droning on about facts and figures. Whether it's snowing or raining, how cold it is, what we do for work, how long it takes to get to work, where we went to school, all those things that we think we have to talk about with someone new, but that tell us little about who that person really is. Why can't we replace small talk with big talk and ask each other profound questions right from the start? Replace mindless chatter with a conversation about our weightiest beliefs and most potent fears. Questions that reveal who we are and where we want to go. Okay. There were some issues with this policy, as my friends were more than happy to point out. They argued that some people aren't comfortable jumping directly into big talk. Some people actually find small talk relaxing. Another common complaint, you can't ask big questions until you know the answers to the small ones. You need facts to know where to dig deeper. I'd argue, however, that you can elevate any question from small talk to big talk with a little tweaking. One of the common questions I find myself asking a woman on a first date is where she has traveled. The response can quickly become a list of places, and once again we're in resume territory. So instead I'd ask, what place most inspired you and why? Rather than ask about her job, I would ask, what work are you passionate about? I wouldn't ask about her longest relationship, as if length equals depth. Instead, I'd ask, what's the most in love you've ever felt? My first chance to put this new strategy into practice came with a woman I met at a party a few weeks later. She laughed when I explained my theory on big talk versus small talk and agreed to be the guinea pig. She was moving away the next week, so we both knew we'd have only this one date, but we pledged to do all we could to avoid small talk. That night, we talked big and we talked deep. I learned about her brother's drug problem, about the ex she had left years before, and about the feelings she still had for him. But we also joked about things both silly and shallow, managing to convince strangers that we had met in a fairground bumper car accident. We laughed, and we cried, and we learned nothing that would go on a resume. Later, we kissed. Since then, staying away from small talk has brought me one positive experience after another. Every date has turned into a real connection, or at worst, a funny story. All it takes is a willingness to dive into conversations that may make us uncomfortable or that many believe to be inappropriate for first dates. After a while, though, it becomes natural to skip the facts and instead seek out our deepest thoughts and feelings. My life moved on. I dated, traveled, and started a new job. After a month of work, I went on a business trip with a new colleague. On the first night away, I found myself engaging in one of those dull work conversations people use to fill the time. My colleague was telling me the basics of his schooling, family, and home. "So how long does it take you to get to the office?" I heard myself ask. Then I stopped, in horror. I remembered the dusty hitchhiker in Costa Rica, the dates and the meaningful connections I'd made by escaping small talk. Even though my colleague and I weren't on a date, we would still be spending a lot of time together in the foreseeable future, on business trips both short and long. I took a deep breath and asked, "Why did you fall in love with your wife?" He looked at me, oddly, thought about it for a moment, and then told me something beautiful.
Paul Rust, reading Tim Boomer's essay, The End of Small Talk. So was this really the end of small talk for Tim? More from him in a minute.
Hi, this is Eric Kim with New York Times Cooking. As a recipe developer, I spend a lot of my time trying to come up with dishes that are quick, easy, but also very special. For me, that means dishes like gochugaru salmon. It's a crispy salmon fillet with a salty, sweet glaze that bubbles up and candies. I love cooking this because it only takes 20 minutes. You can get this recipe and so many more ideas on New York Times Cooking. Visit nytcooking.com to get inspired.
We're back. It's Modern Love, the podcast. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Tim Boomer still lives and works in Boston. He came into the WBUR studios to tell us a little bit more about his life, which became quite interesting after this essay was published in January 2016. He was asked out on Facebook, LinkedIn, and even in the comment section of the New York Times. Tim says he's tried to stick to his no small talk rule, and apparently it hasn't been that hard.
If you Google me, I can't say I've achieved so much in my life that this isn't the top thing that comes up whenever you look. I've had girls tell me on the first thing out of their mouth was to berate the British for the Brexit, to, you know, tell me about other dates they've been on. Then I talked to one girl. I remember she told me she'd come out of a very serious relationship and she's just started dating another guy, but she wasn't sure if she could because they worked in the same profession. And I remember thinking, this is crazy. Like, how small can a profession be? And I said, are they in the same city? And she said, no. And I said, well, how can this be such a big deal? And she looked at me and she said, you know, they're both Blue Men, like from the Broadway show, the Blue Men Group. And I remember thinking, how can, you know, and it's conversations like that, which maybe people wouldn't have opened up about awkward situations and dating, but I could go through every date I had and think of something someone told me that they probably wouldn't want me to say on the radio, but that in the confines of that kind of honest environment was meaningful.
So is he dating a lot now?
I've been seeing a girl for a few months. Unfortunately, I mean, your timing's great on this. Unfortunately, we found out last week that she actually has to return home to Chile. So she'll be leaving in a few weeks, and I guess I'll be back out in Boston asking awkward questions to girls again.
And how does Tim feel about online dating?
So I was, you know, late to dating apps. And I remember some of my friends being on. I actually weirdly conducted a wedding ceremony for two people who met on a dating app. And I remember asking him, is it weird that you met your girlfriend on the dating app? And he said, no, I didn't. I met her in the coffee shop. I didn't get into a long, protracted conversation with her. I just said, hey, you look nice. You sound interesting. Would you like to go get a coffee? And I think that kind of changed my view a little bit on it. I don't think it's one or the other. I think it's just another way to add interesting people to your life. And especially if you want to meet people who work in different worlds, you know, work in radio, then where else are you naturally going to cross with those people sometimes as you get older and you're in bars less and things like that. So I don't think it's ever a bad thing.
Ever since the column was published, Tim has become a love guru of sorts, quite undeservedly, he says.
It's weird. Somebody asked me for dating advice before, which nobody should ask me for dating advice, but somebody asked me at a a function recently, and I was introduced as, this is Tim. He writes a romance column for the New York Times, which was a complete misintroduction, but I thought I would roll with it and give some advice out. And he asked me, what should, having trouble meeting people, what should I do? And I told him, have you ever asked a girl out sober, not in a bar, and not online? And he said, no. And I said, well, that's where you need to start. If you meet someone and you have some interaction with them that sparks something, ask them out and try and do it once a month, you know, do it sober, and then just see where you end up at the end of the year. And he said, what will happen? And I said, they'll probably all reject you. But the good thing is you'll care less at the end of it. And at least now when you do meet that person who maybe you have some spark with, you'll be willing to do it. So I don't know. I'm a firm believer in every avenue is a bonus.
Tim Boomer. His second Modern Love essay was published last week. We'll link to it at wbur.org/modernlove. Stick around, we'll hear from Daniel Jones in a minute.
Hi, this is Eric Kim with New York Times Cooking. As a recipe developer, I spend a lot of my time trying to come up with dishes that are quick, easy, but also very special. For me, that means dishes like gochugaru salmon. It's a crispy salmon fillet with a salty, sweet glaze that bubbles up and candies. I love cooking this because it only takes 20 minutes. You can get this recipe and so many more ideas on New York Times Cooking. Visit nytcooking.com to get inspired.
Welcome back. Daniel Jones, editor of Modern Love for the New York Times, says The End of Small Talk was the most popular Modern Love essay of 2016.
It provoked this reaction that was 50% of the readers completely embracing it and thinking, this is something I want to try, and he's really on to something. And 50% of the people utterly rejecting it and saying, why are you trying to sort of falsely control how people naturally meet? Small talk is a natural thing. It's a way that you gradually get deeper. You can't force that. That's ridiculous. So part of its popularity, I think, was in that tension of it feeling threatening to some people and feeling liberating to other people and them wanting to embrace it and talk about it for that reason. So it just got, you know, hundreds of comments and Facebook shares, and it really got people going. It was a fun essay about breaking out of that autopilot that we find ourselves in when we, you know, meet someone we want to date, when we meet someone at work, just all these ways that we end up spending time with people that are boring and lazy unless we make it some other way.
Dan Jones, editor of Modern Love for the New York Times. Actor Paul Rust says he can see both sides of the small talk argument.
I mean, I certainly have had the experience before of being like, why can't we talk about real things, man? And when you see somebody and you say, how are you doing? Or how are you? Do people really want the real answer? Because I'll give it to them. That was like sort of my adolescent attitude about it. And then I realized if I ask somebody, how are you? And they really got into the nitty gritty, like, I hate my father, and I haven't talked to my brother in 5 years. I would go, oh, no, that's too much information. Just tell me you're good. That's all I need.
Thanks again to Paul Rust. You can see him in season 2 of the Netflix comedy Love. It's streaming now. Next week on the podcast, Rye Russo-Young, director of the new film Before I Fall, on a piece of performance art to help with breakups.
She smiled back, unable to speak, and no one said anything. As I watched Diana in Death Bear, I felt proud of her for being so brave. Maybe it was bizarre to invite a complete stranger dressed as a psychedelic animal into your house to remove your most intimate possessions. Then again, maybe it wasn't.
Modern Love is a production of The New York Times and WBUR, Boston's NPR station. It's produced, directed, and edited by Jessica Alpert, John Perotti, and Amory Sievertson. The idea for the Modern Love podcast was conceived by Lisa Tobin. Iris Adler is our executive producer. Daniel Jones is the editor of Modern Love for The New York Times and advisor to the show. Music for the podcast, courtesy of APM. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. See you next week.